Hi, everybody. It is time for your favorite show on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Points of View. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen, and we're going to continue in the March 2025 issue of The Atlantic Magazine, and we read the feature articles on this show, and this is the feature article, and it is headlined, "Want to Change Your Personality? Have a Baby. I knew that becoming a parent would change me, but I had no idea how." It's by Olga Kassan. In the spring of 2022, I was 36 years old and jumping up and down in my bathroom, trying to figure out my future. I had ordered a fertility test online that said it would provide fast results for just a few drops of blood. The videos on the company's website featured a smiling blonde woman jumping to stimulate blood flow naturally, and then effortlessly dripping blood from her fingertip all over a little strip of test paper. All I had to do was be like her, joyful, fertile. For years, my husband Rich and I had gingerly walked the prime meridian between wanting and not wanting kids, usually leaning towards the no side. Having a baby had seemed unaffordable and impossible. On days when I finished work at 8 p.m., the thought of procreating made me laugh, and then shudder. Recently, though, I'd begun to reconsider. I was in the midst of an admittedly strange-sounding project. I was spending a year trying to change my personality. According to a scientific personality test I'd taken, I scored sky-high on neurotism, a trait associated with anxiety and depression, and low on agreeableness and extroversion. I lived in a constant clenched state of dread, and it was poisoning my life. My therapist had stopped laughing at my jokes. But I had read some scientific research suggesting that you can change your personality by behaving like the kind of person you wish you were. Several studies show that people who want to be, say, less isolated or less anxious can make a habit of socializing, meditating, or journaling. Eventually, these habits will come naturally, knitting together to form new traits. I knew that becoming a parent had the potential to change me in even more profound ways, but I had no idea how. My own mother once said to me, "I can't picture you as a mother." The truth was, neither could I. I wasn't sure I could get pregnant, even if I wanted to. My age put me in a category that was, in a less delicate time, called geriatric for pregnancy, and one doctor told me my eggs were probably of poor quality. The fertility test I'd ordered was meant to determine if those eggs were serviceable. In the bathroom, I unwrapped the glossy white box. The instructions said the test would take 20 minutes and require a pack of lancets. I grabbed one and stabbed into my geriatric forefinger. 2 hours, 5 lancets, and a graveyard of gauze and alcohol wipes later, I still hadn't squeezed a single droplet out of my finger. Was I not jumping high enough? Was I already failing as a mother? I was worried I wouldn't be able to have a baby. I was also scared to death of having one. Arguably, many things are wrong with me. I was raised by Russian immigrants who constantly worried about the dark day was upon us. So hopeful thoughts about the future of humanity don't come naturally. I'm not a person who is affected by cuteness. I've never liked holding or even looking at other people's babies. I don't like animals. I couldn't imagine cooing and smiling at a baby as much as science says you're supposed to for their brain development. My neuroticism made it especially hard to decide if I wanted kids, because no process is more rife with uncertainty than parenting, and nothing scares anxious people more than uncertainty. I worried that Rich and I would fight more and that our relationship would suffer. I worried about sleep deprivation. I felt torn between my lifelong conviction that people shouldn't create problems for themselves and my apparent desire to do just that. I would wake up in the middle of the night and Google things like percent miscarriage pregnant while 36, anxiety, pregnancy, marriage causes, Diet Coke fetal defects, pregnancy brain stops working, hands stop working. These searches surfaced horrific anecdotes, but never any conclusive answers about what I should do. One time I Googled reasons to have kids and found an article that labeled all the reasons I had came up with, like being cared for in an old age and having someone who loves me, while heading not so good reasons to have children. But then I would remember the times we visited Rich's mom, who had dementia in her nursing home. Her face lit up at the sight of him. My son, my only son, she'd say, grabbing his arm. He was the only person she still recognized. The visits were a reminder that the people who matter most at the end are your children. The readers of your blog post won't make this trip. Heather Rankin, a sociologist at Louisiana State University, found in a study that the death of a mother or sibling increased the likelihood that a woman would give birth within 2 years. The proximity of death is perhaps a wake-up call. Who will remember us? The study was based on Rankin's personal experience. When her father died in 2017, she decided not to wait any longer to have kids. His death got her thinking, she told me, about what was important in life, the experience of being loved and the chance to provide that love for someone else. Her first child was born in 2019. There are many reasons to postpone or avoid having children. The cost, the responsibility, the existence of and use cause for Nosefrida. But in addition to those practical challenges, a narrative has taken hold. Everything changes when you become a mother. Once they reach their 30s, many people have carefully cultivated friend groups and sourdough starters for the five-year plans. They really have a good sense of who they are, and then having a baby totally disrupts everything that they thought they knew about themselves, says Lauren Ratliff, a perinatal therapist in Illinois. Of course, this is where I differ from the rest of my cohort. By the time I was ready to have a baby, I'd already been trying to disrupt everything about myself. For my personality change project, I had experimented with science-backed strategies to turn down my neuroticism and amp up my extroversion and agreeableness. I had spent hundreds of hours trying out different iterations of mindfulness, culminating in a day-long meditation retreat that almost killed me with boredom, but somehow alleviated my depression. Among other agreeableness-boosting activities, I traveled to London for a conversation workshop where I learned techniques that can make even British people show an emotion. And to become more extroverted, I went out as much as humanly possible. I played table tennis. I did improv and survived. For the most part, my efforts worked. I'm no longer thought of talking with people a waste of time. I became less afraid of uncertainty and disappointment. I made one good new friend, and I drank less. I had been changing, but it was a type of change that I directly determined. I could go to happy hour or not. I could meditate or stop. I was aware that parenthood would transform me further, but what I found unsettling was that I couldn't know exactly how. Bizarrely, for the biggest disruption of your life, study after study shows there's no typical way that being a parent changes your personality. Some studies have found tiny average decreases in extroversion or openness among new parents, but even those findings are inconsistent. Despite my progress, I was still too neurotic to feel comfortable surrendering control and letting biology mold me into something I couldn't predict and might not recognize. After doctors pronounced me insufficiently fertile, Rich and I decided to just stop being careful 1 month and see what happened. We figured we would at least have some fun before we embarked on an arduous fertility journey. A short time later, on a choppy boat tour in Europe, I couldn't stop leaning over the edge of the catamaran and hurling. "Do you think you might be pregnant?" Rich whispered as the boat crew force-fed me pita bread. "Don't be insane," I said. "Everyone knows that 37-year-olds, especially infertile ones, don't get pregnant on their first try." A week after that, I found out that I had indeed gotten pregnant on the first try. Being pregnant means having your brain replaced with an anxiety t-shirt cannon. I didn't feel glowy or goddessy. I felt crazy. None of my friends has kids, and many of them reacted to my news like I'd gotten a face tattoo. One sent me a TikTok of everything that can supposedly go wrong in a pregnancy, including the possibility that vomit will come out of your eyes. It won't. I spent more and more time by myself, obsessing over which swaddles were best. We ended up not getting any. Thanks to a king tide of hormones, irritability spikes during the first and last trimesters of pregnancy. People say your baby will remember the sounds they hear in the womb, but I fear mine detected little in there other than me screaming at his father. Every few weeks, something would set me off at a deafening volume. If they'd overheard me, these couple therapists who say contempt is the most glaring sign of a failed relationship would probably have advised me to start divvying up our furniture. Sometimes, when I was yelling, being so mean felt amazing, as though I'd finally engulfed Rich in my distress. "Obviously, you need a travel stroller and a regular stroller." I always apologized, and Rich always accepted my apologies. But one time he said, "You know that with a kid, that's not really something you can take back, right?" Sometimes late at night, after yet another argument, I would rotate my spheroid belly towards Rich and ask, "What if I turn out to be a bad mother?" The rest of the pregnancy was horrible. I didn't think it was possible to feel so tired and still be technically alive. At my baby shower, when some friends asked me how I was feeling, I quoted the Russian dissident Boris Nadezhdin, responding to a question of whether he feared imprisonment or death. "The tastiest and sweetest years of my life are already in the past." This is the closest Russians get to excited. 3 days before my due date, after a routine ultrasound, my high-risk OBGYN walked briefly into my room. She looked around for something to sit on and, finding nothing, plopped down on top of a closed trash can. She told me that something was wrong with my placenta and that the baby was in danger and I should now walk over to the delivery wing of the hospital. In the antechamber of the operating room, I hyperventilated in my paper gown and tapped out emails to all my sources and bosses. "I'm having an emergency C-section today, so I won't be available for the next few months. My last day of caring whether people were mad at me." Afterward, while the medical residents were rearranging my innards, I thought I heard one of them ask me something. "I'm sorry, I don't know what's going on down there at all," I said across the blue curtain. "That's probably for the best," the resident said. He came out with white hair, a perfectly round face, and a grumpy expression, like the leader of a former Yugoslav republic. I called him Slobodan a couple times, until Rich told me to stop. Because it was early, we panic-picked a name for him on the short list. Evan. The same day he was born, doctors whisked him away to the NICU. I saw him only a few times before we were all sent home days later. My discharge paperwork said, "Mom is breastfeeding 4 or 5 times a day," which was funny because at that point I had not done it successfully even once. It was also funny because I, quite possibly the least qualified person for the job, was apparently Mom. Once home, we entered the period we now refer to as cute Abu Ghraib. Sleep deprivation addled me to the point that on a call with the pediatrician, I forgot my baby's name. When Evan was 2 weeks old, I bit into a piece of chicken and tasted something bloody and sharp. I had ground my teeth so hard during his NICU stay that I'd loosened a crown. We agonized over whether the gyrations of the snow smart sleeper bassinet would rattle his brain too much, then grow too exhausted to care. I became the CEO of Baby Inc., and Rich was the employee. Number one, we communicated only about ointments and ounces. I finally had the big boobs of my dreams, but the only man who saw them was 2 feet tall and couldn't read. But then something interrupted the misery. One night I was holding Evan while he was sleeping. I had read that singing to your baby was beneficial, so I decided to serenade him with one of the few songs I know by heart, "Forever and Ever, Amen" by Randy Travis. Except I couldn't seem to get through the fourth line. "This love that I feel for you always will be." I, a bad bitch who had never cried at a wedding, kept choking up. Rich asked me if I was okay. "Whatever," I said, tears rolling down my cheeks. "Shut up." I thought motherhood would be a forced march through inert babyhood and feral, fetal toddler years before we finally reached the golden time of my imagination, having a talking, precocious elementary schooler. But there I was, flooded with adoration for someone who barely registered my presence. I'd hated being pregnant, so I thought I would hate having a baby too. But I loved him. I love this. Recall the research showing there's no one way that parenthood tends to change people's personality. Anecdotally, researchers told me that they do notice certain patterns among new parents. Most moms worry about their kids more or less constantly. From the minute they find out they're pregnant, signing up to be a parent is signing up to have a lifetime of some degree of depression and anxiety, Ratliff, the therapist, told me. New parents' satisfaction with the romantic relationship goes down, especially for mothers and especially the first year. Guilt is another universal, says Audrey Athen, a clinical psychologist at Columbia University's Teachers College, who researches a transition known as matriscience, the creeping sense that you should be with your kid while you're working, and working while you're with your kid apparently never goes away. She told me that mothers become more attuned and pro-social, more caring and empathetic towards others. Adam said this is why so many mothers cry when their babies cry and have a hard time watching gory movies. Moms get a really bad taste in their mouth with violent television or looking at images of war, she said. That's where she lost me. My son had colic for the first 4 months. He screamed like possessed unless he was within the juggly confines of his snoo. The doula we hired referred to him alternatively as Mr. Cheeks and Mr. Crab, and sarcastically, Mr. Wonderful. If I had cried every time he cried, I wouldn't have had time to do anything else. Eventually, Rich and I grew desensitized, or felt like we had to match his chaotic energy with equally intense stimuli. One night after Evan wailed in our ears for 2 hours, we shuffled downstairs and collapsed onto the couch. There was only one thing we could think of to watch that would serve as a come down for what just happened. Saving Private Ryan. Did you remember to sterilize the pump parts? I asked Rich as the entrails of American soldiers spilled out over the beaches of Normandy. The sterilizer thing broke, so I had to reset it, he said as a man stumbled around with his arm blown off. Even within these supposedly universal rules of parenthood, that is, there's a lot of variability. That's because life events like parenthood seem to change everyone differently, and how you'll change is in part up to you. For a recent study, Ted Schwabe, a psychologist, a physiologist at Michigan State University, and his co-authors asked thousands of Dutch people about a life event in the last 10 years, such as a divorce or a new job, they felt had changed who they were as a person. About 7% of participants identified parenthood as the event that changed them, and on the average, they felt that it made them slightly more agreeable and conscientious. But the big takeaway for Schwabe from looking at all the data from all the different types of life events was that there was really no pattern. Some people became more extroverted when they got a new job. Some became less so. Some people actually became less neurotic, that is, less depressed and anxious, say, after a cancer diagnosis. To Schwabe, the research suggests that it's how you experience an event, such as parenthood, more than the event itself that determines how you'll change. And the same event, like getting divorced, might be someone's worst thing that's ever happened to them and for someone else. It might be the best thing that's ever happened to them, he told me. Or your personality might change not immediately after an event like childbirth, but through a long process that the event sets in motion. It's not the cry you hear in the delivery room that changes you. It's the many years of researching childcare and soothing boo-boos that gradually turn you into someone new. To change, you have to take steps every day to do so. Having a baby won't make you a better person. Behaving like a better person for your baby will. Of all the things I wanted motherhood to change about me, neuroticism was high on the list. Before I had Evan, I felt like I was personally responsible for making life unfold perfectly, and whenever I failed to do so, I had a meltdown. On one day a few years ago, I had a bad haircut, got stuck in traffic, and had professional photos taken that looked terrible. My response to this, what my new parent eyes now see, is an 8 out of 10 days, was to chug half a bottle of wine and scream at my husband through sobs. I hate everyone and everything. But now so much goes wrong every single day that there's no time to get upset about any one thing. I recently took a flight with Evan by myself, an exercise that really underscores the first noble truth of Buddhism, that life is suffering. As I hauled the car seat, the stroller, the baby, the diaper bag, and the trendy and practical tote from my childish years to the TSA line, an airline attendant took one look at me and said, "I know, it's too much." In the middle of the flight, I noticed that the 2 bottles of formula Evan nervously drank during the takeoff had caught up with him and that he was now soaked with pee. I grabbed him under his armpits and scooted across seats to change him in the airplane's postage stamp sized bathroom. With one hand I held him, crying, on the changing table, and with the other I dug a clean onesie out of the bottom of my diaper bag. I fastened a million tiny onesie buttons. Then I saw that I had misaligned them and fastened them again. Next it was my turn. I couldn't leave him on the changing table or put him on the disgusting floor. I yanked my leggings down and held them at arm's length as I peed. By the end of that ordeal, I felt accomplished and capable. I didn't feel like sobbing. I felt like high-fiving myself. I've let go in other ways, too. I show up at important meetings without makeup on. I say weird stuff to strangers, and I don't analyze it obsessively later. Evan has forced me to step outside myself, to break from the relentless self-focus that has contributed to both my success and my unhappiness. My remaining neuroses are laser-directed on his well-being. I had initially planned not to breastfeed, but once I started, I got so into it that when a doctor suggested that Evan would spit up less if I cut food allergens from my diet, I stopped eating virtually anything but oats and spinach for months. When I was pregnant, we'd signed the unborn Evan up for daycare. But as the end of my maternity leave loomed, I embarked on a frantic search for a nanny so he could stay close to me while I worked from home. I had always mentally mocked parents who checked to be sure their babies were still breathing at night, then found myself standing in front of his crib at 3 a.m., feeling for puffs of air from his two tiny nostrils. I yell at Rich less than I used to, because not only is he employee number one of Baby Incorporated, but he's the only employee, and frankly, there are no other applicants for the job. In fact, the whole experience has made me kinder and more tender, like the Grinch post-heart enlargement. I'm less worried about wasting time because all the time with a baby is essentially wasted, the most important nothing you'll ever do in your life. I even love Evan's wet, violent kisses, which leave his baby teeth imprints on our jaws. When my friend Anton visited recently, he watched me make horsey noises for Evan for what probably felt like hours. "I can't believe you love an infant," he said. During my interview with Ratliff, I told her that Evan had lately been losing interest in breastfeeding. I had awaited this day through months of bleeding nipples and frustration, but now that it was here, it was making me a bit sad. "Your baby's moving to the next stage," she affirmed, "and this one is not going to come back again." I started tearing up, both at the memory of those bleary, milk-soaked months, together with the realization that he wouldn't even be a baby much longer. During my personality change experiment, my meditation teacher had tried to hammer home the idea that this too shall pass is both uplifting and sad. Nothing bad lasts forever, but neither does anything good. Before I had Evan, I was focused on impermanence's upside. The uncomfortable improv show will end. This awful pregnancy will too. But now I'm more keenly aware of its downsides. The sleepless nights will end, but so will the times Evan squeals at a game of peekaboo or spends an entire swim class gazing up at me at awe. Every day brings a sigh of relief and a pang of nostalgia. Having someone who loves you, I've decided, is a good reason to have kids. And that was "Want to Change Your Personality? Have a Baby," by Olga Kazan in the March 2025 issue of The Atlantic magazine. And we're about halfway through the show. Just a reminder, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View, and this is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. And just a reminder, if you want to go back and listen to that story again, it's pretty easy. Just download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app on your phone or on your tablet, and you'll find the feeds, the live feeds from Tucson, from Flagstaff, and from Tempe. And if you go down a little farther, you'll find every show that's broadcast that you can stream or you can download, and you will find this show, Points of View, in the entertainment section. And we're going to continue in the March 2025 issue of the Atlantic magazine. And this article is titled, Why the COVID Deniers Won, Lessons from the Pandemic and Its Aftermath, by David Frum. 5 years ago, the coronavirus pandemic struck a bitterly divided society. Americans first diverged over how dangerous the disease was. Just a flu, as President Donald Trump repeatedly insisted, or something much deadlier. Then they disputed public health measures, such as lockdowns and masking. A majority complied, while a passionate minority fiercely resisted. Finally, they split and have remained split over the value and safety of COVID-19 vaccines. Anti-vaccine beliefs started on the fringe, but they spread to the point where Ron DeSantis, the governor of the third most populous state, launched a campaign for president and an appeal to anti-vaccine ideology. 5 years later, one side has seemingly triumphed. The winner is not the side that initially prevailed, the side of public safety. And the winner is the side that minimized the disease, then rejected public health measures to prevent its spread, and finally refused the vaccines designed to protect against its worst effects. Ahead of COVID's fifth anniversary, Trump, as president-elect, nominated the country's most outspoken vaccination opponent to head the Department of Health and Human Resources. He chose a proponent of the debunked and discredited vaccines costism claim to the CDC. He named a strident critic of COVID vaccine mandates to lead the FDA. For Surgeon General, he picked a believer in hydrochloroquine, the disproven COVID-19 remedy. His pick for director of the National Institutes of Health had advocated for letting COVID spread unchecked to encourage herd immunity. Despite having fast-checked the development of the vaccines as president, Trump has himself trafficked in many forms of COVID-19 denial and has expressed his own suspicions that childhood vaccinations against measles and mumps is a cause of autism. The anti-vaxxers may ultimately prove fleeting, but if the forces of science and health are to stage a comeback, it's important to understand why those forces have gone into eclipse. From March 2020 to February 2022, about 1 million Americans died of COVID-19. Many of those deaths occurred after vaccines became available. If every adult in the United States had received two doses of a COVID-19 vaccine by early 2022, rather than just the 64% of adults who had, nearly 320,000 lives would have been saved. Why did so many Americans resist vaccines? Perhaps the biggest reasons was that the pandemic coincided with a presidential election year, and Trump instantly recognized the crisis as a threat to his chances for re-election. He responded by denying the seriousness of the pandemic, promising that the disease would rapidly disappear on its own, and promoting quack cures. The COVID-19 vaccines were developed while Trump was president, but they could have been advertised as a Trump achievement. By the time they became widely available, Trump was out of office. His supporters had already made up their minds to distrust the public health authorities that promoted the vaccines. Now they had an additional incentive. Any benefit from vaccination would rebound on Trump's successor, Joe Biden. Vaccine rejection became a badge of group loyalty, one that ultimately cost many lives. A summer 2023 study by Yale researchers of voters in Florida and Ohio found that during the early phase of the pandemic, self-identified Republicans died at only a slightly higher rate than the self-identified Democrats in the same age range. But once vaccines were introduced, Republicans became much more likely to die than Democrats. In the spring of 2021, the excess death rate among Florida and Ohio Republicans was 43% higher than those among Florida and Ohio Democrats of the same age range. By the late winter of 2023, the 300-odd most pro-Trump counties in the country had a COVID-19 death rate more than 2.5 times higher than the 300 or so most anti-Trump counties. In 2016, Trump had boasted he could shoot a man on Fifth Avenue and not lose any votes. In 2021 and 2022, his most fervent supporters risked deaths to prove their loyalty to Trump and his cause. Why did political fidelity express itself in such self-harming ways? The onset of the pandemic was an unusually confusing and disorienting event. Some people who got COVID died. Others lived. Some suffered only mild symptoms. Others spent weeks on ventilators or emerged with long COVID and never fully recovered. Some lost businesses built over a lifetime. Others refinanced their homes with 2% interest rates and banked the savings. We live in an impersonal universe, indifferent to our hopes and wishes, subject to extreme randomness. We don't like this at all. We crave satisfying explanations. We want to believe that somebody is in control, even if it's somebody we don't like. At least that way, we can blame bad events on bad people. This is the eternal appeal of conspiracy theorists. How did this happen? Somebody must have done it. But who and why? Compounding the disorientation, the coronavirus outbreak was a rapidly changing story. The scientists who researched COVID-19 knew more in April 2020 than they did in February, more in August than in April, more in 2021 than in 2020, more in 2022 than in 2021. The official advice kept changing. Stay inside. No, go outside. Wash your hands. No, mask your face. Some Americans appreciated and accepted that knowledge improves over time, that more will become known about a new disease in month two than in month one. But not all Americans saw the world that way. They mistrusted the idea of knowledge as a developing process. Such Americans wondered, where were they lying before, or are they lying now? In a different era, Americans might have deferred more to medical authority. The internet has upended old ideas of what should count as authority and who possesses it. The pandemic reduced normal human interactions. Severed from one another, Americans deepened their parasocial attachment to social media platforms, which foment alienation and rage. Hundreds of thousands of people plunged into an alternate medical universe during COVID-19 lockdowns. When their doors reopened, the mania did not recede. Conspiracies and mistrust of the establishment, never strangers to the American mind, had been nourished and they grew. The experts themselves contributed to this loss of trust. It is now agreed that we had little to fear from going outside in dispersed groups. But that was not the state of knowledge in the spring of 2020. At that time, medical experts insisted that any kind of mass outdoor event must be sacrificed to the imperatives of the emergency. In mid-March 2020, federal public health authorities shut down some of Florida's beaches. In California, surfers face heavy fines for venturing into the ocean. Even the COVID skeptical Trump White House reluctantly canceled the April 2020 Easter egg roll. And then the experts abruptly reversed themselves. When George Floyd was choked to death by a Minneapolis police officer on May 25th, 2020, Hundreds of thousands of Americans left their homes to protest, defying 3 months of urgings to avoid large gatherings of all kinds, outdoors as well as indoors. On May 29th, the American Public Health Association issued a statement that proclaimed racism a public health crisis while conspicuously refusing to condemn the sudden defiance of public safety rules. The next few weeks saw the largest mass protests in recent U.S. history. Approximately 15 to 26 million people attended outdoor Black Lives Matter events in June 2020, according to a series of reputable polls. Few, if any, scientists or doctors scolded the attendees, and many politicians joined the protesters, including future Vice President Kamala Harris. It all raised a suspicion. Maybe the authorities were making the rules up based on politics, not science. The politicalization of health advice became even more consequential as the summer of 2020 ended. Most American public schools had closed in March at their peak, Education Week reported. The closures affected at least 55.1 million students in 124,000 U.S. public and private schools. By September, it was already apparent that COVID-19 posed relatively little risk to children and teenagers and that remote learning did not work. At the same time, returning to the classroom before vaccines were available could pose some risk to teachers' health and possibly also to the health of the adults to whom the children return from school. How to balance these concerns given the imperfect information? Liberal states decided to favor in the favor of the teachers. In California, the majority of students did not return to in-person teaching until the fall of 2021. New Jersey kept many of its public schools closed until then as well. Similar things happened in many other states, Illinois, Maryland, New York, and so on, through the states that voted Democratic in November 2020. Florida, by contrast, reopened most schools in the fall of 2020. Texas soon followed, as did most other Republican-governed states. The COVID risk for students, it turned out, was minimal. According to a 2021 CDC study, less than 1% of Florida students contracted COVID-19 in school settings from August to December 2020, after the state restarted in-person learning. Over the 2020 to the 2021 school year, students in states that voted for Trump in 2020 election got an average of almost twice as much in-person instruction as students in states that voted for Biden. Any risk to teachers and school staff could have been mitigated by the universal vaccination of these groups. But deep into the fall of 2021, thousands of blue state teachers and staff resisted vaccine mandates, including more than 5,000 in Chicago alone. By then, another school year had been interrupted by closures. By disparaging public health models and discrediting vaccines, the COVID-19 minimizers cost hundreds of thousands of people their lives. By keeping schools closed longer than absolutely necessary, the COVID maximizers hazarded the futures of young Americans. Students from poor and troubled families in particular will continue to pay the cost of those learning losses for years to come. Even in liberal states, many private schools reopened for in-person instruction in the fall of 2020. The affluent and the connected could buy their children's continued education, unavailable to those who depended on public schools. Many lower-income students did not return to the classroom. Throughout their 2022 through 2023 school year, poorer school districts reported much higher absenteeism rates than were seen before the pandemic. Teens absent from school typically get in trouble in ways that are even more damaging than the loss of math or reading skills. New York City arrested 25% more minors for serious crimes in 2024 than in 2018. The national trend was similar, if less stark. The FBI reports that although crime in general declined in 2023 compared with 2022, crimes by minors rose nearly 10%. People who finish schooling during a recession tend to do worse, even in middle age, than those who finish in times of prosperity. They are less likely to marry, less likely to have children, more likely to die early. The disparity between those who finish in lucky years and those who finish in unlucky years is greatest for people with the least formal education. Will the harms of COVID prove equally enduring? We won't know that for some time. If past experience holds, the COVID-19 years will mark their most vulnerable victims for decades. The story of COVID can be told as one of shocks and disturbances that wrecked two presidencies, in 2020 and 2024. Incumbent administrations lost elections back-to-back, something that hasn't happened since the deep economic depression of the late 1880s and the early 1890s. The pandemic caused a recession as steep as any in the U.S. history. The aftermath saw the worst inflation in half a century. In the 3 years from January 2020 through December 2022, Trump and Biden both signed a series of major bills to revive and rebuild the U.S. economy. Altogether, they swelled the gross public debt from about $20 billion in January 2017 to nearly $36 billion today. The weight of that debt helped drive interest rates and mortgage rates higher. The burden of the pandemic debt, like learning losses, is likely to be with us for quite a long time. Yet, even while acknowledging all that went wrong, respecting all the lives lost or ruined, reckoning with all the lasting harms of the crisis, we do a dangerous injustice if we remember the story of COVID solely as a story of American failure. In truth, the story is one of strength and resilience. Scientists did deliver vaccines to prevent this disease and treatments to recover from it. Economic policy did avert a global depression and did rapidly restore economic growth. Government assistance kept households afloat when the world shut down, and new remote work practices enabled new patterns of freedom and happiness after the pandemic ended. The virus was first detected in December 2019. Its genome was sequenced within days by scientists collaborating across international borders. Clinical trials for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine began in April 2020, and the vaccine was authorized for emergency use by the FDA in December. Additional vaccines rapidly followed and were universally available by the spring of 2021. The weekly death rate fell by more than 90% from January 2021 to the midsummer of that year. The U.S. economy roared back with a strength and power that stunned the world. The initial spike of inflation has subsided. Wages are again rising faster than prices. Growth in the United States in 2023 and 2024 was faster and broader than in any peer economy. Even more startling, the U.S. recovery outpaced China's. The nation's bounce back from COVID-19 has been slow and faltering. America's economic lead over China, once thought to be narrowing, has suddenly widened. The gap between the two countries' GDP grew from $5 trillion in 2021 to nearly $10 trillion in 2023. The U.S. share of the world economic output is now slightly higher than it was in 1980, before China began any of its economic reforms. As he did in 2016, Trump inherits a strong and healthy economy to which his own reckless policies, notably his trade protectionism, are the only visible threat. In public affairs, our bias is usually to pay most attention to disappointments and mistakes. In the pandemic, there were many errors. The partisan dogma of the COVID minimizers and the capitulation of states and municipalities to favored interest groups, the hypochondria, the neuroticism of some COVID maximizers. Errors need to be studied and lessons heeded if we are to do better next time, but we fail to acknowledge America's successes, even partial and imperfect successes. We not only do an injustice to the American people, we also defeat in advance their confidence to collectively meet the crises of tomorrow. Perhaps it's time for some national self-forgiveness here. Perhaps it's time to accept that despite all that went wrong, despite how much there was to learn about the disease and how little time there was to learn it, and despite polarized politics and an unruly national character, despite all that, Americans collectively met the COVID-19 emergency about as well as could be reasonably been hoped. The wrong people have profited from the immediate aftermath, but we remember the pandemic accurately. The future will belong to those who rose to the crisis when their country needed them. And that was Why the COVID Deniers Won: Lessons from the Pandemic and Its Aftermath by David Frum in the March 2025 issue of The Atlantic magazine. And we just have a couple minutes to fill here for our show. And there's actually a poem here in the March 2025 issue of The Atlantic. And it's titled Reflections by Kreslaw Milslav. An ant trampled, and above it clouds. A trampled ant, and above it a column of azure sky. And in the distance, marking its blue steps, the Vistula of the Dipner in its bed of granite. This is the image reflected in the water. A city ruined, and above it clouds. A ruined city, above it a column of azure sky. And in the distance, stepping over blue thresholds, the remains of history or the spring of myth. A dread field mouths and beetle gravediggers. On the footpath, running a seven-year joy. In the garden, a rainbow-colored ball and laughing faces, and the yellow luster of May or April. This is the image reflected in the water. A defeated tribe, armored gravediggers, along the road running a millennial joy. A field of cornflowers blooming after the fire, and the silence is blue, everyday normal. This is the image reflected in the water. And the footnote says that Kreslaw Milslav, he was 1911 through 2004, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1980. This poem, translated into English, appears in a new volume of his work, Poet in the New World. And that will bring us to the end of this week's Points of View. It's been a pleasure reading for you. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen, and we will talk to you next week.